So tonight's reading is by Charles Williams, and I'll say a little bit about Charles Williams after the reading. Many promising reconciliations have broken down because while both parties come prepared to forgive, neither party come prepared to be forgiven. So tonight's talk is inspired by the great Charles Williams. Any of you ever hear of Charles Williams? It's always sad when you know that someone as great as Charles Williams is largely lost to history. Charles Williams was born in the late 1800s, and he was a very incredibly intelligent man. He was afflicted by two things. One, he came from a very poor background, and two, his eyesight began to go bad when he was a young man. And he eventually, near the time of his death, when he was 58, he was going nearly blind. So these were things that affected his life and his story. He went to St. Albans Prep School, which was a very good school in England, and then he won a scholarship to the University of London. But despite his gifts and all of that, because of his financial situations, he was unable to finish or get a degree. So he always loved writing and was such a great writer and such a great literary critic that he was eventually hired by the University of Oxford for their publishing department. And it was very quickly seen that he had incredible skills at proofreading and just at criticism, and he had a wide breadth of history and philosophy and theology. And so he quickly rose to the ranks, by which time, near the end of his life, he was the head of that department. He was the head of the University of Oxford publishing department without a degree. And he also became renowned for his writing and his poetry, and in fact was at one point the head of the poetry department for the University of Oxford. His writings and his poetry were deeply impressive to those who knew him, including folks like, you probably have heard of, T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden, who were huge fans of his. His most famous works are his fiction. He wrote supernatural fiction. And so his two most famous pieces are The Descent into Hell and All Hallows Eve. And All Hallows Eve is probably my favorite, which I'm rereading again for the umpteenth time. He was very much into studying theology, and he wrote histories of theology, and he was actually included in the Inklings. Have any of you ever heard of the Inklings? The Inklings was a private group of individuals who got together at a pub, infamously known as the Bird and the Baby. Members of this Inkling group, there were only a few, were C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Dorothy Sayers. And Charles Williams. And it was a great joy for me whenever I was in Oxford that we would go to the pub and hang out in the back room where these guys did their stuff. That's where they would read stuff to each other. And if you look this stuff up, there's really interesting stories. When Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings, he first read it there in that pub to the others to get their opinion and get their feedback. Some great stuff. But for me, Williams is more important because of an order he founded called the Order of Co-Inherence. Now, he was coming from a sort of a mystical Christian background, but he very much, I think, was in tune with a lot of the things that we would teach. And so he created this Order of Co-Inherence. And The Order of Co-Inherence was based on a profound understanding of the interdependence of all existence. that are interdependent forms, those are the reality behind the stuff of creation and a defining quality of oneness. And there were certain practices that were enjoined from that. The first practice was the idea that these principles, we talk about them as the three principles, these encapsulated what he believed coherence expressed. And it was expressed most dramatically through the practice of love. And I'm using my own words to sort of interpret some of what he was saying, but the process of love was bearing witness. So in our practice, we talk about not knowing, bearing witness, and healing action. So I understand what Williams was talking about within that understanding or that regard. And so what was the specific meaning for him related to this? The first was the process of bearing witness, which was the process of living with each other through the loving and healing action of sharing tasks and responsibilities. In other words, that we would bear one another's burdens as a community. And the practice that was done in his order, which is similar to the one that we do, is found in both the way that we offer pastoral care, but also in counseling. Because what you're doing in that situation is, whether it's care, where you're mainly just listening to someone who's going through a very difficult time, or it's counsel, where you're not only helping them to bear the burden of what they're experiencing, but you're offering them a way or a path out of that. And so this bearing witness practice is one way to express this sense of this coherence that he used that word, or we would say oneness or interdependence. And there were two aspects to this practice. The first was called, and it's actually often categorized as romantic theology, because it's all based on love. And it's the idea that all worldly aspects of love are but a reflection of a deeper, more sacred idea of love. And that ultimately they point the lover towards oneness. This is known as the way of affirmation. In his words, the way of affirmation was not rejecting the world as corrupt and therefore evil, but one should begin with the notion that the world is shunyata, and that we can transmute the various aspects of this world into an enlightened vision of society. And this way of affirmation is about seeing oneness in all people and all things and in all circumstances of life. But there's also another part of the practice, and this was called the way of the shadow. And the way of the shadow focuses on the transcendence and otherness and the dynamic quality of the grounded being or the Dharmakaya. Williams expressed this, and he expressed these two ways as a paradox. And these are classically known as the via positiva and the via negativa in classical contemplative practices. So I wanted to kind of start with just his understanding of that and the way within which he was trying to express these practices for his time and place. This ceremony that we do tonight is a very old ceremony, and it was the understanding that human beings, in a sense, as they go through their life and they have various experiences, that there are things that happen to them or things that they do that cause them consternation or create or cause suffering. And that these things over time become what we would call ghosts. These are things that tend to haunt us. And so when we're going about our day, you know, we see something, we hear something, and it can trigger in us this experience of this ghost that represents this old stuff. And so, what do we do with that? Well, there's two things that we do. The first thing we realize is that the haunted house of our mind is built a certain way by certain conditioning. And the first thing we want to do is stop supporting that conditioning so that that house has no foundation anymore. But the other thing that we want to do is we want to feed those ghosts. In other words, we want to be able to not just kind of disassemble the foundation of the haunted house itself, but we want to do something with those ghosts besides just sort of pushing them out. Because the idea is that if we only do that, that those things remain as a part of our shadow, things that we have not yet integrated. So the feeding of the hungry ghost is a way of integrating the shadow. In fact, this whole ceremony is a way of dealing with the shadow aspect of the psyche. There's the movie that I think expresses this the best. There's a couple of them, but the one I think expresses it the best is The Sixth Sense. Have you guys ever seen The Sixth Sense? So in that, there's a young boy who sees dead people, right? That was the famous meme that came out of it. And he's frightened of these ghosts. And he has this counselor, the actor Bruce Willis plays this counselor, who is trying to help him to deal with these ghosts and this haunted house, which is his life. And at one point, Willis's character says to the boy, maybe instead of turning away from them, you should face them and you should listen to them and see what they have to say. And so this becomes the turning point in the film, because now the ghosts just want to be heard. They want to be understood. And once they do that, they leave them alone. And that, I think, is really one of the best fictional descriptions of what we're doing tonight. And so when we enter the space to do this, what we're enjoined to do is to think about those things that we want to put behind us. In other words, we want to let go of. And when we say let go, a lot of people have the idea of letting go as this. So when you open things up, it's that kind of experience. But our sense of letting go is this, so that we understand and we see everything, and nothing is lost. Everything is integrated. And the important part of this practice is that we recognize that we can't do this. Sometimes when we have stuff in our past, we think that there's some kind of relentless sort of kismet involved. And it colors all of our life, that everything that we experience then on out just proves this bad mojo we have going on. But one thing that we can do once we engage in some sort of practice like this, whether it's formal or informal, is we can realize that that's not how it really works. That the karma of the past, which is a Sanskrit word to define cause and effect, that karma isn't some sort of kismet or some sort of destiny, but rather it's certain things that have occurred in the past, but they don't have to continue into the future. The Buddha gave various sort of illustrations of this. One was like, imagine your mind like a field, and it has all these seeds of all these experiences in. What you want to do is you want to burn out all the seeds that you don't want to grow. And the ones that you do want to grow, after you've burned out the ones that you don't, then you nurture and water and give sunlight to those seeds so that you grow new seeds. And that the negative seeds never come to fruition. The other image that I like a lot is that of a stream running down a mountain. because eventually all waters try to reach back to the sea. And so if that stream's coming down the mountain, it might seem relentless and that it's only going to go one way. But if we somewhere midway in that stream divert it, then it won't go that same direction and it will go in a new direction. So the Buddhist concept behind this was the idea that we can truly be free from the karma of any negativity from the past. And we free ourselves through the practice of mindfulness and through certain sort of rituals like this, where we say to ourselves, okay, I'm done. I'm now moving on in a new direction. I'm not going to give life to that old stuff anymore. And I'm not going to reject that ghost, but I'm going to feed it by caring for it and giving it compassion. And then we can move forward refreshed in our life, not holding on to those things. And the reason I used this quote from Charles Williams was that, reconciliation, because that's another English interpretation of the ceremony of reconciliation and healing. And often the hardest part that we have is learning to forgive ourselves. We can forgive others. And often, even if that's difficult, we find that we kind of move there first. But forgiving ourselves and letting go of those things is something that we often find harder to do. But that is what this ceremony is about. It's about learning to forgive yourself and then being able to let go of the past so that you can enter into your life refreshed and new. And in the Buddhist cycle of liturgy of the year, we always start here because, you got to start with that kind of burning out and getting rid of the old stuff so that you can start to nurture the new. And then we move from here into the great Feast of Enlightenment. And so it's just a very beautiful and cool ceremony. So classically, and no one has to believe this literally, in the classic Buddhist cosmology, it was believed that when people die, sometimes their consciousness is not able to continue its spiritual evolution. So because of a strong attachment or an aversion event, that being may become a hungry ghost. It's stuck in between. It hasn't been able to cross over into the realm of light. It has to sort of get stuck here. And sometimes it doesn't even know it's stuck. So another aspect of this ceremony in ancient times was the idea that at certain times of the year, there is something called the liminal. And this was a space by which the ghosts could commune with the living. And of course, this isn't just in Buddhism, this is all over the world. That's why we have things like Samhain, Halloween, things of that nature. But the Buddhist approach to it was to invite all the hungry ghosts in and do so in a way that we would then feed them so that they could be released from their past and they could move on in their spiritual evolution. So I think it's kind of cool, whether you believe in it literally or not. I think it's pretty cool. And finally, I want to say something about the ceremony with regard to one of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, the late Bernie Glassman. And for him, when he founded the Zen Peacemaker Order, he wanted to have a central rite or liturgy that would be practiced. And for him, it was this ceremony, the feeding of the hungry ghosts. Because part of his awakening experience was one time where he suddenly found himself in this space where he heard all these voices crying out. And he realized that all these hungry ghosts were crying out to be heard, to be fed. And so that became the central motif of his life. And he saw it not just in terms of the psychology, but he saw it as all those in our society that are like hungry ghosts, those who've been cast out, those who don't fit in. One of the great actions of his life was a devotion to the homeless. And he experienced the homeless as hungry ghosts. I had my own experience of this many, many years ago. I was going through a difficult personal time, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life. And I was feeling very, very destructive. And I remember when I got to sort of the penultimate expression of that grief, if you will, the total exposure of myself to the shadow. And this is before I met Bernie or knew his story. I had a similar feeling. I had this sense of all these people that I had not even met yet crying out to me saying, no, no, we will need you. You need to do this with your life because they're out there and you don't even know them yet. And so I've always taken that also as a central idea behind my practice. So it's a beautiful ceremony. You know, as we always say with any of our ceremonies, you know, do with them what you will. We want you to understand what it's about, but do whatever feels right for you. So when you make your offering tonight, we'll get some pens. All I want you to do, and you don't have to write them out, obviously there's not much on here, but you can just write a letter or a word or something that symbolizes that for you. And we'll do this a little bit during our meditation time and just reflect and write that down and then hold on to that. And then when you come forward, you will light your piece of scroll or paper, and then you'll put it in the main incense offering. When you come up, just bow and then light your offering and then put it into the bowl and then just bow slightly. And then it's customary when you turn around to bow to everybody and then go back to your seat. The clergy will go first and they'll kind of show you. So what I'd like to do at this time, and Mike, I just realized that I don't know if that candle is still remaining lit, but if it's not, would you take the votive from the lady altar and put it just on top of the candle there? Would you do that now? And Ev, if you wouldn't mind, there's some pens there on the table. Mm-hmm. Would you give those pens out?
Sure.
And Haley, if you would you would you take one and pass this in? Thank you. Thank you. So let's just take some quiet time, and those of you that are watching with us from home, take time to do this as well. If you watched last week on Monday, I said this is the beginning of the Sagaki season, so we take that week, those 9 days to reflect. But 7 to 9 days. But tonight, just take a little bit of time and reflect on what it is you want to let go of so that you can start fresh.